capacity in Gaza to maintain organized human life so that people would have to leave, so that Gaza is being emptied out completely. And that's the main concern.
And Mohammed, finally, if you could talk about the continuing Israeli assault in the West Bank, in particular on Jenin.
So basically, part of the gift bag that Netanyahu gave to his extremist minister, Bezalel Smotrich, to agree to the ceasefire in Gaza was to extend the war goals under the radar quietly to include the West Bank. So now the West Bank, from Israel's perspective, is a war zone. So that's why you have, for example, Israeli checkpoints booming and skyrocketing all across the West Bank, despite the IDF chief of staff, who is a settler himself, Herzi Halevi. He is not a pro-Palestinian left wing, but that IDF chief of staff, he warned Netanyahu and Smotrich. He said, don't put these checkpoints. It will lead and push Palestinians to take to arms, to armed resistance, to resist Israel's occupation. But Netanyahu overruled him. In Jenin, you have a way worse dynamic than the rest of the West Bank, where Israel is trying to turn it into a clone of Gaza, ethnic cleansing, pushing people out and destroying homes systematically one after the other. All of it is to explode the West Bank, to use it as a pretext for a major war to push Palestinians out. That's the agenda of Israel's extremist ministers at the moment.
Mohammed Shahada, we thank you so much for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, she survived human trafficking and now helps others out of the same trap she was in. People who depend on SNAP food benefits have less protection from the crime of benefit theft. And Pacific Northwest senators have tough questions for President Trump's cabinet nominees. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 30th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon SNAP users are no longer protected from theft. Food benefits, which are stolen from the 1 in 6 Oregonians who use SNAP, will no longer be replaced under a new law. Benefit theft happens largely through the skimming of cards. As Isabel Charlet reports, while it is rare, it can be devastating for Oregon families.
People who receive food benefits through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program will no longer be reimbursed if their benefits are stolen. Sarah Weber Ogden with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon says losing these protections will harm Oregon families. She says skimming, when a device on a card reader steals personal information, is the main way benefits are stolen. Ogden emphasizes that even though rates of skimming are very low, it can be devastating to victims.
I don't think that people who haven't experienced it really understand what it's like to suddenly find out you don't have any money for food. It really is just a feeling of absolute helplessness.
President Joe Biden signed the protection into law in 2022 as part of the Farm Bill, but it was excluded from the latest version signed last year. Ogden says when protections like this end on a federal level, it places the burden on the state to pick up the tab. Currently, nearly 700,000 Oregonians, or 1 in 6, receive SNAP benefits. Ogden adds since the Farm Bill has been extended, the door is still open to push for a more inclusive SNAP and other nutrition programs. More than half of SNAP participants in Oregon are families with children, and Ogden says ending the theft reimbursement program is taking a step backwards.
We remember how bad it was for families before before the replacement benefits program was available.
Ogden says if you have had benefits stolen before December 20th, you may be able to get them replaced if you act quickly. She adds that you can protect yourself from theft by blocking out-of-state and online spending, freezing your card between uses, and changing your PIN regularly. Ogden says if you need help finding food, you can visit foodfinder.oregonfoodbank.org to locate free groceries or meals near you. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Multnomah County commissioners have declared this Human Trafficking Awareness and Prevention Month, and today they heard from a survivor of the crime who now helps others escape the life.
My name is Andrea Matheny, and I'm a lifelong resident of Multnomah County. I am the mother of a 17-year-old who will graduate from a Portland public high school this June. I'm a legislative coordinator for a political advocacy nonprofit. I'm on the endorsement committee for the Mother PAC. And I'm also a proud member of the steering committee for SWAA, which is Sex Worker Affirming Advocates. I'm here today to share my personal experience as a survivor of domestic violence, financial abuse, and sex trafficking. I stand before you, sit before you, as not only someone who has survived, but as someone who believes that we have the power and responsibility to make meaningful change. Like many, I became a vulnerable target due to a lack of accessible resources and support. I was once a young mom, many moons ago, struggling to provide financial stability for myself and my young child. I was escaping a domestic, violent, dangerous, abusive partner. I was trapped in a cycle of violence, lack of resources, with limited education beyond high school, and a family who did not have the resources to help me. This led me to be pulled into several years of sex trafficking in Portland and Seattle, which was incredibly coercive and difficult to escape. I felt trapped and unable to leave due to fears of retaliation, as well as fear of losing the small financial empowerment I felt I had finally found. We know these things don't happen overnight, nor do they happen in a vacuum. The lack of resources, support, and opportunity for those in these situations, particularly for those in marginalized communities, leave many with extremely limited options. The reality is that there simply are not enough resources to seek shelter, childcare, and most importantly, healing. There are not enough programs for survivors to rebuild their lives. Another important piece of sex trafficking that is often not discussed is the criminalization of consensual sex workers, who are simply trying to make a living, but are also vulnerable to exploitation and abuse under our current laws. Decriminalizing consensual sex work would help minimize unsafe underground spaces where they are at risk of harm and unable to seek help due to fears of legal repercussions and losing their children. By decriminalizing sex work, we can start to dismantle the structures that allow sex trafficking to thrive in the shadows. It would mean safer working conditions, greater access to the available resources that do exist, and the ability for workers to report abuse without fear. But decriminalization is simply not enough. We must invest in resources for both those who wish to exit the sex trade and those who wish to continue working safely. We need housing, mental health resources, job training, legal aid, and long-term support systems to help individuals regain their agency and autonomy. And most importantly, we need to listen to the people who actually work in the industry and/or have lived experience of trafficking as the experts that we are. We can offer critical insights into what is actually needed on the ground. By working with people who have lived experience, we can develop more effective, compassionate policies. I ask you today, commissioners, to take a hard look at the systemic gaps that make exploitation possible, invest in resources both for survivors and for those who are vulnerable to becoming victimized themselves. Please advocate for policies that prioritize decriminalization to ensure the safety and dignity of all people. And most importantly, make sure that those who know the realities of sex work, sex trafficking, and survival are not only heard, but are integral to the solutions that we come up with together.
My name is Claire Barrera. I'm the sex trafficking senior strategist with Multnomah County's Domestic and Sexual Violence Coordination Office. I also coordinate the Multnomah County Sex Trafficking Collaborative. Human trafficking is a global issue that also impacts many people in Multnomah County. As an example of the magnitude of this issue, the county-funded New Day program has served 623 unique youth since 2018, between 2018 and 2024. All of those youth were identified as survivors of sex trafficking or at very high risk of sex trafficking. In addition to youth being vulnerable and at a higher risk, we know that other marginalized communities in Multnomah County face disproportionate rates of trafficking. LGBTQIA+, Black, Indigenous, and immigrant communities are especially vulnerable to exploitation, as discrimination and racist and xenophobic policies and practices limit opportunities for safety and liberation. The Immigrant and Refugee Community organization in our county has a program that serves survivors of human trafficking, both labor and sex trafficking. It's called Services Against Exploitation. In the fiscal year 2023 through 24, this program served 77 unique survivors and more than 40 of their family members. As war and environmental catastrophes destabilize other nations, and anti-immigrant sentiments and legislation are on the rise in the United States, we know that those things will put immigrant and refugee communities at increased risk of being trafficked. The Multnomah County Sex Trafficking Collaborative was founded to address these concerns and pool our resources to end trafficking and improve care for survivors. Our collaborative includes law enforcement, prosecutors, mental health providers, and culturally specific providers, among others. We also have our community advisory board to ensure that people with lived experience in trafficking have a voice in the work we do. In 2024, this board planned and implemented the first anti-sex trafficking focus conference in our county in many years. The conference trained over 125 local professionals who screened survivors into our housing and shelter options. The second thing that our board accomplished is they reviewed and significantly improved the training and tool that professionals in our area use to screen survivors into our housing and shelter options. Traditionally, trafficking survivors have not been well screened into those services. These improvements will help trafficking survivors have equitable access to those resources. This year, 2025, it feels especially important to highlight the experiences of immigrant and refugee survivors of human trafficking and those who work with them. We must ensure these communities are included in our anti-trafficking policies, services, and funding.
And that was Claire Barrera, the Sex Trafficking Senior Strategist for Multnomah County DCHS. Today, a Washington U.S. senator grilled President Trump's cabinet pick for Health and Human Services. Patty Murray questioned Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about his changing views on vaccines and allegations of sexual harassment against him.
In light of last night's tragedy, I do want to express my thoughts and prayers. But it is, I think, a painful reminder to all of us that we need competent people running our federal agencies to respond when a crisis strikes. Mr. Kennedy, I think we all agree that cancer is particularly nefarious chronic disease. And the American Cancer Society reported earlier this month that women under 50 are experiencing a dramatic increase in the incidence of that disease. Fortunately, there is clear data showing that the HPV vaccine has saved lives and cut cervical cancer rates dramatically. You have called the HPV vaccine, quote, dangerous and effective, and said it actually increases the risk of cervical cancer. Do you stand by those statements, yes or no?
The HPV vaccine, you know, I brought litigation. I represented.
Yes or no?
I represented.
Stand by your statements.
Let me answer.
I'm trying
Senator.
To yes or no. It's a simple yes or no.
I
stand by your previous statement.
I litigated on that issue. I represented hundreds of young girls who felt that they were injured by the vaccine. That trial is happening right now in Los Angeles.
Well, let me ask
those questions will be answered by a jury in that trial.
You said that no loving parents would allow their daughter to receive that vaccine. If confirmed as HHS secretary, would you recommend that parents get their children vaccinated against HPV?
I recommend that children follow the CDC schedule. And I will support the CDC schedule when I get in there, if I'm fortunate enough to be confirmed.
Would you recommend the parents get their children vaccinated against the measles? Yes or no?
Against measles? Yes.
Well, I just remind everybody that parents look to our health leaders for advice on these decisions. You would be a health leader, and for the record, I would like to put into the record his previous statements on these vaccines. I do want to ask you a question about character. I still believe character matters, and I want to let you respond to this. You were accused of sexual harassment and assault by Eliza Cooney, who was first hired as a part-time babysitter by your family. When you were confronted about this accusation, you said you were, quote, not a church boy, and that you, quote, have so many skeletons in my closet. You then texted Ms. Cooney an apology and indicated you had no memory of what she described. Mr. Kennedy, I'm asking you to respond to those accusations seriously in front of this committee. Did you make sexual advances towards Ms. Cooney without her consent?
No, yes. I did not. And that story has been debunked.
But why did you apologize to her then?
For, I apologized for something else.
That's not my understanding. Are there, let me just ask
you. All you have to read is the text which she published. It's not for that.
That is not how I've read it. Are there any other instances where you have made sexual advances towards an individual without their consent? Just yes or no?
No.
No. Mr. Kennedy, you said that you're going to say to NIH scientists, God bless you all. Thank you for your public service. We're going to give infectious disease a break for 8 years.
Excuse me?
You said you were, you just said thank you for your service to our federal employees. You want to give infectious disease a break. That's a quote. Will you support the development and distribution of vaccines for the avian flu, yes or no?
Will I, for the avian flu, yes.
My time's almost up, but having read a lot and listened a lot, I just want to remind all my colleagues that by voting to confirm Mr. Kennedy, we would be telling our constituents he's worth listening to. That alone could get people killed before he even lifts a finger, because he does not even need the levers of power to influence people, as we saw in Samoa. All he needs is a megaphone. To affirm his views by voting to confirm him as our highest health official, we should not mince words about what that would mean. When babies die from whooping cough because parents weren't sure if the vaccine was safe, we will have to look them in the eye. When measles sweeps through school, then hospitals, nursing wards, will this be worth it? There are political realities, we all get that, but there's also right and wrong, fact and fiction. And there's also people staying healthy or dying pointlessly from diseases we can prevent because they thought Congress took its job vetting our health care secretary seriously.
The full U.S. Senate could decide as soon as next week on a vote on whether to confirm Kennedy. Meantime, Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden questioned another Trump cabinet pick, Tulsi Gabbard.
We've been talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and I believe it's critical that the DNI support additional reforms to protect the privacy of law-abiding Americans. In your written response to committee questions, you wrote, and I quote, warrants should generally be required before an agency undertakes a U.S. person query of Section 702. Is this your current position?
Yes, it is, Senator. And as you'll note in that written response, I noted some exigent circumstances with which
with
there may be other options. But I also want to make a note that a simple warrant requirement is ultimately going to be a policy decision that all of you will make. I would point to history, to some examples.
I'm glad you answered in line with your written answer that you support a warrant. Section 702 also involves a huge loophole now that was included recently that could allow the government to force anyone with access to a Wi-Fi router or cable box to secretly participate in the warrantless surveillance program. Do you support, as I do, eliminating this language?
Senator, I would have to look more into that and assess, if confirmed, what the impacts of the implementation of the existing safeguards are and come back to you in Congress as you look at reauthorization.
It is a massive loophole, and I hope to hear, after you've looked at it, that you'll be supportive of my efforts. Let me turn now to the question of the Inspector General situation. Can the President of the United States refuse to fund the Inspector General for the intelligence community despite appropriations from Congress? And here I'd like a yes or no.
Senator, I don't know about the legal authorities, but I understand the essential role that the Inspectors General play. And if confirmed, look forward to empowering our Inspector General to fulfill their responsibility.
Good, because Congress either has the power of the purse or it doesn't. And I think in your answer to me, you recognize that you have an independent obligation to follow the law. I think that's a constructive answer. Let me turn now to the matter of spying on journalists. You wrote in your response to the committee questions that you support the Biden administration Department of Justice's policy restricting the collection of reporters' records, and you called for the codification of those restrictions. Will you reconfirm that position?
I believe strongly in the First Amendment, which protects a free press.
So you will, in effect, say that you will continue to support the Biden administration policy to protect journalists?
I'm not familiar with the specific Biden administration policy, but I believe strongly in the defense of the First Amendment.
It is a policy that restricts the collection of reporters' records, and you have called for the codification of those records, so I am going to accept that you're not changing your position, and I appreciate it. While you were in Congress, you introduced legislation prohibiting the government from mandating that Americans' phones or apps include mechanisms to allow the government to bypass encryption or other privacy technology. In your written responses to the committee questions, you reconfirmed your opposition to these mandates. Is that still your position?
Yes. These back doors lead down a dangerous path that can undermine Americans' Fourth Amendment rights and civil liberties.
Let me turn to whistleblowers. You wrote in your response that whistleblowers must have clear protected channels to report concerns, including the unauthorized transmittal of classified information to appropriate entities such as members of Congress. Do you agree that IC whistleblowers must have a clear path to this committee and that they don't need permission from agencies to talk to us? That's a yes or no.
Senator, the answer is clearly yes. I would like to state a few other actions I would take if confirmed as Director of National Intelligence is, number one, make sure that we don't have illegal and unconstitutional programs within the intelligence community, making sure that we enact security clearance reform to limit access to our nation's top secrets, make sure that every single person in the workforce understands their rights as whistleblowers and the legal channels to take, which would include coming directly to you as members of Congress, as well as establishing a direct hotline to myself should they choose to take that path.
Would you support the declassification of the committee's full report on the CIA's torture program?
Senator, I believe in transparency. I have not seen this and so cannot make an honest assessment for that answer.
If senators approve, former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard would become the Director of National Intelligence. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a winter storm watch is in effect for the Cascades from central Oregon to the Canadian border, starting tonight and lasting through Saturday afternoon. The Portland area will see rain tonight with a low near 40. Tomorrow's weather, rain continues, a high of 51. Today in history, on this date in 1948, Mahatma Gandhi, the Indian leader who advocated for nonviolent protest, was assassinated. Our quote of the day is from Gandhi, "The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong." A trial is ahead for a Berkeley, California-based animal activist accused of trespassing, theft, and conspiracy. Suzanne Potter reports she took chickens from a slaughterhouse during her own investigation into alleged animal abuse.
An animal activist is speaking out ahead of her trial in May, accused of trespassing, theft, and conspiracy after a protest at a poultry slaughterhouse in Northern California. 22-year-old Zoe Rosenberg is charged with one felony and four misdemeanors for removing four birds from Purdue's Petaluma poultry in June 2023. Rosenberg was part of a group of protesters with the Berkeley-based animal rights organization Direct Action Everywhere.
I believe that the necessity doctrine applies to non-human animals when they are in situations where they're facing life-threatening abuse or neglect, as these chickens were. And so I believe that my actions were legal and necessary.
Purdue did not respond to a request for comment. The Sonoma County District Attorney's Office says no city or county agencies have referred a case requesting criminal charges against the poultry operation. Direct Action Everywhere's investigation reported multiple alleged abuses, including chickens found starving, unable to walk to the feeding station. Rosenberg says she's disappointed that she's facing charges, but not Purdue.
Rampant, routine criminal animal cruelty was documented, including chickens suffering from disease and neglect, being left to slowly die evidence of this misconduct was repeatedly reported to Sonoma County law enforcement, and no action was taken.
Rosenberg was ordered to wear a GPS ankle monitor while awaiting trial. She faces up to 5.5 years in prison if convicted on all charges. Charges were dropped against one other activist. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
President Trump signs the Laken Riley Act. The administration ends temporary protected status for Venezuelan immigrants, and the White House rescinds the memo freezing federal aid, but still causes confusion and chaos, with more on the stories impacting our democracy. Here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
We also want to thank President Trump for the promises he made to us. He said he would secure our borders and that he would never forget about Laken.
Allison Phillips is the mother of Laken Riley, a 22-year-old nursing student killed by a Venezuelan migrant last year while jogging on the University of Georgia campus. President Donald Trump signed the Laken Riley Act Wednesday, giving federal authorities more power to detain and deport illegal immigrants accused of even small crimes. Trump says he plans to send up to 30,000 immigrants to Guantanamo Bay as part of his mass deportations. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem says they need places to hold the people they will detain.
Is something that the White House is working on to use resources that we currently have there at Guantanamo Bay. So we'll go through the process. The worst of the worst is where that could be utilized.
The White House also ended a Biden-era 18-month extension of temporary protected status for Venezuelans. The move revokes the work authorization for hundreds of thousands and makes them susceptible for deportation. Under immediate bipartisan backlash, the Trump administration has reversed a Monday memo freezing trillions in federal grants and loans. The White House insists the freeze is still in effect, provoking added confusion. Taylor Ucker Lauterman with the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence says the funds for domestic violence groups mean life or death for survivors.
Whether there is a federal funding freeze or it is rescinded, this still causes challenges to providing crisis services to survivors. Our time right now is focused on making Plan B and Plan C, but for this week, the services are truly being impacted and interrupted.
The Senate is confirming former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. He's expected to roll back environmental regulations and relax seasonal restrictions on gasoline sales. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says Zeldin should support biofuels.
I'm encouraged that Mr. Zeldin is willing to work with Congress on President Trump's promise of year-round E15 sales. Restoring energy dominance will require an all-of-the-above approach.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Trump's paused funding freeze and rescinded memo caused tribal funding confusion. The Interior Department starts to redesignate Denali's American name back to McKinley, and coyotes are more abundant in areas where they're hunted, a new report finds. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
Tribes across the country are continuing to monitor actions being taken by the Trump administration after the White House rescinded a memo Wednesday on a temporary halt on federal loans and grants. A memo issued this week on the funding freeze caused confusion and concern across Indian country. Southern Indian Ute Tribe Chairman Melvin Baker said they recognize the importance of programs and services that rely on these funds and that the federal government has a solemn obligation to honor its trust responsibility and financial commitments. The Interior Department has begun to take steps to designate Denali as Mount McKinley in Alaska. This comes after President Trump's executive order to return the mountain to a name change made in 1917. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has more.
If she were alive today, Pauline Carla would probably sing her Denali song to protest President Trump's executive order. Carla was in her late 90s when she performed her Denali song at a Dinakanaga Elders and Youth Conference. She had greeted President Obama with that same song when he visited Alaska in 2015, the summer his administration changed the name back from McKinley to Denali.
When it was named back to the original name of Denali, it just felt so good and it was healing.
Angela Gonzalez remembers when Pauline sang that song for Obama. In her Athabascan Woman blog, she wrote about it and the joy she felt over the return of the ancient name.
The feeling of a great land and untold stories from our ancestors.
Angela's maiden name is Yatlin, which means runner, and refers to her family's long history of trading goods.
We definitely traveled a long ways.
Where the mountain was part of a long network of trails that went all the way from Siberia to California. And Denali, which means tall one in her Koyukon Athabascan language, was an important landmark.
We were people who traded everywhere.
Angela says no matter what the president does, Denali will always be Denali. I'm Rhonda McBride.
New research suggests that coyotes are more abundant in areas where hunting them is allowed. Caroline Long for the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Coyotes are native to the southwestern United States, but they have expanded their range rapidly in the last century.
Now they're found basically throughout all of North America. Our main goal was to figure out what are the environmental and human-led factors driving this expansion.
Austin Green is an associate instructor at the University of Utah. He analyzed data from Snapshot USA, a network of camera traps across the United States. Research found that in Utah, Wyoming, Montana, and Nevada, where hunting and trapping coyotes is barely regulated, coyotes are more abundant.
There was no evidence across our model or across other investigations that unregulated coyote hunting is a legitimate population control measure.
I'm Caroline Long.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 30th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our